Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
This podcast is brought to you by The Word magazine, media partner of Latitude Festival 2010.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Are we rolling?
We're rolling.
So, I want to know, how was your dressed crab? Last time I saw you, last night about 10 o'clock, and you were saying, frankly, a smug air, you said, tonight, I'm going home soon, back to my huge, great rolling pile in Walthamstow, you know, which is... This is a suburb of South Wales, so prosperous, they have to surround it with a moat to keep the hoi polloi out, Fraser. Mark and I have somehow lucked his way into this place. He said, I've got to go back at a certain point. I'm going to have dressed crab and a glass of rosé, you said.
In my defence, this is true. In my defence, I did say this apologetically because, you see, the terrible irony, listeners, as I'm sure you're aware, is that David Hepworth is a very enthusiastic patron of rose-covered cottages in seaside towns. And I'm a massively energetic camper.
Mark Ellen is a hedge monkey.
By a weird twist of fate, I have finished up staying in this marvellously appointed cottage, you know, with Tracy McLeod on one side, Richard Curtis on the other.
Emma Frost.
All the quality. Get up in the morning, as I say, highly appointed novelists are out there with their small children on the swings.
Don't need an iron in your copy of The Observer this morning.
Exactly, and I had a little bracing dip in the sea while my wife did some sketching, and we came back and dined extensively on raspberries and bacon sandwiches.
Meanwhile!
I know, and last night, now you're right, what happened was we saw about four or five songs by Bell and Sebastian, and the old text message came in saying the dressed crab awaits. So we had to jump in. I know, I can't believe this, because normally, as Fraser will testify, I am a rave animal. It's the last one to drop. 4 a.m.
Well, Mark Allen's retired now, and I've taken up the guttering flame.
How's it going?
David, actually, I don't know how... How fresh do I seem now,
Fraser?
Better than yesterday.
Better than yesterday, because I had no sleep first night, thanks to the person who played the blues. But person playing the blues has gone victim to blues fatigue and wasn't playing it last night. So I got a full 7 hours and I had a shower this morning, Mark.
But that's cheating.
Just again, simply because you didn't approach it with the right practical attitude.
You haven't read the rules. You haven't read the small print, have you, of your contract with festivals?
I haven't washed.
Well, I haven't. I haven't had a shave, and that's because I'm desperately hoping if I bump into any word readers, they think that I have been roughing it out in the woods, you know. But actually, you know, I've, as you say that.
But it's been going well.
It's going very well.
Spotted any famous people, Fraser?
No.
Oh, I did.
Who have you seen?
I was standing on the bridge yesterday afternoon, trying to help my wife get in position for a performance of the Matthew Bourne ballet of Sleeping Beauty. Swan Lake, tell a lie. And this guy was looking at me as if he was worried I was going to try and edge in, you know, but next to where he was. And I thought, he's familiar. And then I thought, do you know, he looks like the original Hannibal Lecter. It was Brian Cox.
Wow.
The great actor, who was the original Hannibal Lecter. How exciting was
that? Was he performing? Was he on stage?
No, he was just there with, I assume, it was Mrs. Cox or whatever. And they were
camping.
And then
go to the rock karaoke stage.
Yesterday evening, when I was going to inspect the psychedelic sheep, you know, which are covered in, you know, animal, vegetable dye.
That's right. There's an orange one and a blue one.
There are all sorts of different ones.
Those sheep must feel really hacked off, because, you know, once a year somebody comes along, paints them blue, they must think, oh, God, the noise, the people, racket's going to start up again. You know?
So who was alongside me inspecting said sheep? Keith Allen. So, you know,
that's good work.
I've seen a few celebrities. Have you seen anybody?
No, probably not. I mean, I suppose I've obviously seen some quite high-ranking people, but they've been on stage, not just wandering about with a folding chair. That's what you're talking about.
I'm talking about, yes.
I had a highlight yesterday, which I I have to tell you, because it was actually really exciting. I went to see my old pal Robin Hitchcock, who's been playing on about 8 stages simultaneously. And this wonderful production pass I'm wearing around my neck, of course, gets me everywhere. Unless I actually want to sing with Belle and Sebastian, I can pretty much do everything else, which is so perfect.
It's a mercy to us all.
It's superb. And it saved a lot of suffering. So I'm backstage at the Literary Tent, and Jeremy Hardy's on stage, and Robin's about to go on and play a song. And Jeremy's wife comes up with a birthday cake, some candles and a lighter, and a load of those little poppers that you pull a string and they explode, and it's a big celebration. I said, could we go on stage in the middle of his political rant, wish him happy birthday, pull the poppers, give him the cake, and sing happy birthday with the crowd at the Literary Stage? I quite enjoyed that.
So you sang happy birthday?
We sang happy birthday. I've got some photographs of it.
When
I played Latitude,
yes,
that'll be dropped.
With Jeremy Hardy, we've worked together.
Yeah. So Belle and Sebastian, you enjoy?
I enjoyed that. I saw a lot of stuff. I saw twice I've seen the Marcus Brigstoke, Rufus Hound, Phil Jubitus improv comedy set, where they just read stuff out of newspapers and just try and wring a little comedy out of it, which they do very successfully. I found myself in the opera this morning.
I saw it at the opera last night.
Did you?
In the woods.
You didn't see the Ballad of Sadler's Wells, did you?
I don't know. I was just wandering through the woods and I thought, what does that sound like? That sounds like an opera performance. And behind a tree, sure enough it was. Very beautiful stage set up with, you know, the trees in the background. I do think the use of the forest is
fantastic.
It's terribly good.
We were going back last night for the Dress Crab, making our way across the pontoon bridge with my old pal Amanda, and suddenly we see that there's what appears to be highly drilled dancers dancing to a giant discotheque on a floating stage in the lake. Did you see this thing?
No.
And when we look closely, we were thinking actually these were rather inexpert, these particular dancers. We realised that actually it was just members of the public. So I'm afraid to say we got involved. Yeah.
You got a rug.
Yeah. She took a picture of me twisting furiously.
Oh,
to a bossa nova classic.
In the words of
with a sort of huge psychedelic hillside behind me. I thought it was quite good. I thought I've really made an effort.
In the words of the late Hugh Green, we want to see it.
We want to see it.
But I saw
Sebastian Faulks too. That was very good. Literally.
He was
a lovely bit where somebody asked him a question about writer's block. And he said, I don't believe in writer's block. He said, it's God's way of telling you that you haven't got any decent ideas. Which I thought was quite good.
You just got to keep
talking about Alan Bennett, who once said that he likes to... I can't possibly do the accent. Which, Dave, you can do this for me. It's a Yorkshire accent.
I can't do Alan Bennett.
Alan Bennett is his way to write. He had to get up every morning and sit down in front of the machine to see if anything's come in. Which is a lovely idea, is it? You're looking in your mental inbox to see if you had an idea.
Checking the post.
Checking the post.
The key thing is just got to keep working. And you know, you don't know whether anything you write is any good until long afterwards, very often. So, musically, you saw John Grant, didn't you? Who you like?
We saw John Grant yesterday, and that was rather... I'm a huge admirer of John Grant. I didn't know much about him, actually. He was in the Czars, wasn't he, Fred? 10 years ago? A long time ago.
They made 5 albums,
I think. They made 5 albums, and he had a very distinctive voice, quite distinctive way of writing, and then fizzled out for various reasons, which we shall soon discover, and we all know, probably. For about 10 years, it was out of focus, and was in a sense kind of rediscovered partly by the patronage of Midlake, about to be on stage in fact in about 20 minutes time, and they just were very enthusiastic about his old records and said they would help manage, promote, give him a studio, and generally reactivate his career. And I like this record so much. We played it 70s Johnson, Kate Mossman and myself particularly very fond of this, and you were too actually in the Word office. So he got played a lot, I think, with community singing.
Been on the Word
CD. I'd been on the Word CD, and there was a point yesterday when he was about to come on stage, and I thought, well, I'd like to get quite close, because the wonderful thing about festivals like this with huge screens is there is no real reason to be at the front. In fact, you can see quite a lot better if you're further back and see the Diamond Visions, you know. So I spent most of John Grant's set on my own, pressed against the railings underneath the stage like a kind of teenager, watching, and it was absolutely fantastic.
And afterwards...
Kate and Mossman, who's, again, possibly a much bigger fan, actually, than I am, an obsessive fan, when told...
Dangerously so.
When told that her main job this weekend would be to escort John Grant to the Word signing tent to meet his people, virtually passed out, didn't she? So Mossman and myself called him and said, would you like to come in and talk to us? And it was terrific, absolutely terrific. I said, you'll play it now, in fact. He came into this... overheated porter cabin, and we had about 25 minutes of extraordinary conversation. So can you hear, actually, or feel, people listening, the incredible...
Hello.
Powerful... can you hear the drums?
I can hear the vibes and the beats and the...
Isn't that
the reverb. That's
amazing. I love that.
The entire...
You can feel it right in the testicles. That's good bass.
That's good bass, that is. How very exciting. We've just been joined very briefly by John Grant. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much.
And we have Kate Mossman here as well. Kate and I are enormous. We can't conceal our admiration for John.
I was just saying, this is kind of unusual, because often when I interview people, I'm very detached because I'm not bothered about their stuff. And with you, I actually am. So I just thought, what I'm going to do is sit there and say, how come you're so great?
Yes, it's going to be one of those. It's like being interviewed by Hello Magazine.
I know.
You know, how are you? How are you so brilliant?
You're really great. Care to comment?
Care to comment, exactly. In fact, Kate, didn't you, am I right, when John played the... Union Chapel in London about a month ago. Didn't you go up and look at his keyboard or something?
We went along to see him, and I was interested in this keyboard which you have, which has all these very... It reminds me of a keyboard I had when I was a kid that had a voice called Dog Piano.
Wow.
Which is basically a kind of synthetic yap sound that you could tune, and it was amazing. So the album's full of all these weird things, and I went up and had a look at what kind of keyboard it was, and then I looked it up online and saw if I could buy one, but it was too expensive. So
They're really expensive, aren't they?
They're really expensive.
Those Swedes, everything's expensive up there. The Scandinavians in general, I would say.
Yeah.
I've sort of fallen in love with Scandinavia, but it's so damn expensive
up there. How did you first find out about those keyboards? Because they're quite retro in their sound, aren't they?
Yeah. They were some of the first of that generation of digital analog keyboards that were supposed to recreate digitally that sound from the analog keyboards. Of course, you know, most people say that they have not been successful in doing that. but it has the Nords from, it's a company called Klaviyo, and they make, you know, the Nord Stage and the Nord Leads and all that. And I just remember going over to a guy's house in Denver a long time ago, and he had one, and I crap my diaper right away. You know? I just couldn't believe what I was seeing or hearing.
Yeah,
you know?
And they're bright red, aren't they? This is a Nord Lead 3 for anyone interested.
Yeah. And they're always
kind of keyboards.
It's funny, the Midlick boys. They have the Midlick boys have a stage from Nord as well, but they don't like that red color, so they've got all this gray tape on it to cover up the color. Yeah,
wow.
But I dig it.
Less likely to get stolen, I guess.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I suppose if it looks crap. Yeah. I mean, they do cost, you know, $3,000.
They're about $3,000, aren't they?
Yeah. That might have stages to steal. For sure.
Mm. Explain the relationship with Midlake, who are actually playing on our stage in about 2 hours' time, aren't they? What was the involvement with Midlake?
We had both been on Bella Union for many years, and I was sort of fed up with the music business. You know, I hadn't had any success with my group, the Czars, and we all hated each other. And you know, I was
standard
just
rock and roll stuff.
Yeah. And I was doing the the prerequisite for the book. You know, for my book or my Hollywood movie, by, you know, getting in deep into the drink and the drugs and everything. So I was just sort of floundering about, and I was really, you know, depressed about the music industry. And they sort of, you know, just picked me up and sort of, they asked me to play a couple of shows with them, and they loved my voice so much that they kept bugging me to come and do an album with them. And, you know, the offer that they were giving me was, or what they were offering was, come and use our studio for free. Mm. Come and live with us for free, and we'll be your backing band for free, and we'll play your album.
So that's a pretty generous offer, isn't it?
It's amazing.
Tick every box, I think.
Yeah,
it's
and
like a
so
commune.
Obviously, you know, as any you know good human would be, I was skeptical and didn't believe them.
What's the catch in it?
Yeah.
Yes,
do you
that's
have to
right.
clean?
Just, you know,
do you have to cook or something?
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Clean the toilet and stuff.
Well, that would be their funeral, you know. But so I molded about, and I was living in New York at the time, and I was doing quite well there. I have this other life that I lead with languages, where I, you know, speak German and Russian and Spanish, and I had just finished getting a certificate in Russian medical interpreting. And
explain how that happened, that you became so good linguistically.
I started with German in my senior year in high school, and did really well at it, and I was sort of directionless at the time, didn't know what I wanted to do, so I decided to do languages. And I got to go on some trip, you know, with my college to Germany for 6 weeks or something like that. And then I fell in love with it and decided I needed to study there. So I went and studied there for 6 years. And then Yeah, and studied translation, and I started learning Russian. That was 1988. I can't believe how long it's been since I started learning that language, and it's still difficult.
So do you actually work as a translator as well?
Yeah, I worked at the NYU hospital as an interpreter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From lots of different languages? From
no, just Russian.
Just Russian?
Yeah. Because, you know, all the Germans speak English, so...
Yeah, that's true.
But there's a huge Russian community in New York, you know, out in Brighton Beach and Sheepshead Bay and all over the place, actually, that of, you know, older folks that don't... speak English.
Where does it hurt in Russian? That kind of thing.
Yeah. На что вы жалуетесь?
Three times a day.
Call me for the telly.
That's a fabulous Russian accent.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So I want a bit more Russian. Just describe this porter cabin in Russian. We see if we can guess what you're saying.
Ну, это очень сложно было бы. Я не знаю вообще, что это такое.
But that's something that she's being rude about the shirt you're wearing. She looks terrific.
Да, рубашка. Ну, блузка мне очень нравится. Ну, что вы говорите?
It's amazing. So how long did it take you to become fluent in Russian then? Because it's really difficult to learn.
A long time. You know, because first of all, I was studying, you know, I had no prior knowledge of Russian, and I was studying it in German at a German university. So you can imagine doing Russian grammar for the first time in another foreign language. Mm. That makes the whole thing that much more difficult.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had passed the proficiency exam for the German university, but that didn't by any stretch mean that I was perfect in German yet. So the first 3 years, you know, they really pound you with the grammar for the first two semesters, and then you start off immediately translating newspaper articles and stuff like that.
Tough?
Yeah, it was really tough. But I, you know, I loved it. I was in heaven over there, you know, and I stayed for 6 years. It took me a lot longer because the Russian was really difficult. The test from German into Russian was the one that many people fail.
Yeah.
Germans included. And I had to take it three times. And you only get to take it three times. And if you don't pass it the third time, then you can't study that, not only at that university, but at any other university.
So on the third time, you passed?
And the third time, I got a 2, which is one short of the best grade.
So does everyone in the hospital know about your music career? Is it difficult to balance?
I was going to say exactly the same thing. Did you live two complete twin lives? I mean,
I was sort of giving up on music for a while. Mm. You know, I was saying, you know, you're in your 40s now. You need to get serious about your life. Do you really, you know, you have no insurance, you have no retirement plan, you have no car, you have no... you know, house, you have none of these things that you're supposed to have, you know, when you're... but I got this offer from Midlake because I played a show with them at Webster Hall and then also at the Bowery Ballroom in New York City. And they just kept after me. And I finally, you know, when I realized that they were serious, obviously I had to take that risk. Mm.
But it's the most fantastic story, don't you think?
Yeah,
a complete turnaround. I mean, we've just watched you playing the Obelisk stage at Latitude here to an enormous, an incredibly enthusiastic. It must be a wonderful thing for you.
Oh, it's
to
amazing.
Look out and see that level of interest and encouragement.
Yeah, it's.
And how does this album compare to the stuff you're doing with the Czars? Because it seems very confessional. Is it? Do you feel this is a result of what you've been through in the last 10 years with the music industry and stuff? Has all gone into this record?
Well, I mean, this record is pretty much about my life up until this point.
Yeah.
You know, sort of in a nutshell. You know, just a lot of things that maybe I didn't feel comfortable saying with the Czars because it
what
was
sort of things?
Drug abuse. You know, growing up in a religious family as a gay man.
Yeah.
A lot of the gay issues. You know, these days it's not really much of an issue, but I haven't really dealt with mine yet.
Yeah.
You know, so the fact that a lot of the young kids are like, what's your problem? You know?
Yeah.
Nobody really cares anymore. But the thing is, people, there still is tons of discrimination. Mm. I mean, if you go to YouTube and look at all the comments under all of the videos.
Really?
Yeah, it's like, you know, get out of here, you fucking faggot, and faggot this and faggot that. So it's obviously...
So it's good that you wrote JC Hates Fags to preempt
that. Well, yeah. I mean, I wanted to talk about the anger that I have felt, you know, because, you know, the first 20 years of my life, I was told directly and unequivocally, you know, so that there was no mistake, you know, you're a piece of shit because you're a pervert. And you don't have the same rights as other people.
And this
because
is
you're not.
And
this is a fantasy to do with the religion, isn't it?
Well, and just there's a lot of people that feel that way who aren't religious at
all. There's this line in the song as well, you know, JC hates pretty much anything you want him to.
Exactly. Like, yeah, and that's what people do, right? You know, I don't like cornflakes, so you know, God doesn't like cornflakes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it must be that way. You know,
and was this a small? Were you living in a small town as well?
I did. Until I was 12, I grew up in a small town, and I was, you know, we left there when I was 12, but I, for those first 12 years, maybe for 5 of those years, I was dealing with that knowledge that was growing inside of me that I was attracted to men.
Mm.
And it was also communicated to me that it wasn't okay, you know. And so I felt ashamed of myself.
Yeah.
And I think that I think it's really difficult for you to grow into a confident person if you literally feel like you're a second-class citizen, that you don't have the same rights as other people.
Yeah.
You know, so I have acted that way all my life. I've been extremely hard on myself because I'm doing, you know, what's difficult is now that you, when you become an adult, you become responsible for your life and you have to take out the trash, mm-hmm. right? You have to take care of all the shit that happened to you, figure out some way to cope with it, you know, and I was finding it very difficult to cope with it
mm-hmm.
because, you know, people weren't attacking me anymore. Physically or verbally, I was doing it.
Yeah.
I took the torch, you know.
Yeah.
And then I was doing it to myself. And so I've been doing it to myself for the last...
Well, when we were watching the song about, you know, I'm sorry I wasn't born with skin that turned to golden brown, and I wish I was this, I wish I was that, and I was standing with Mike, our production editor, who said it's really interesting to hear this coming out of a guy who's older, rather than, because this is somebody who's 18, says these kind of things and beats themselves up about this kind of thing, and then to hear somebody who's older saying that is so refreshing as well, because you never stop feeling that kind of thing.
No, but, I mean...
Well, as you were saying, you just didn't get the opportunity to do that when you were younger, didn't you?
Yeah.
The times have changed, you know.
Yeah. And I think there's also a point when you become an adult where people around you say, all right, that's it. You're an adult now.
Put it away.
Put that away.
Yeah.
You're done. But that's not true. That doesn't exist.
Mm.
That's not that's not what happens with human beings.
Yeah.
It continues, and you just keep it covered up. Well, I didn't want to keep it covered up, and I think, you know, one of the things I wanted to say during this interview is that, you know, some people say, well, why is this, you know, why is this so personal? It's so, you know, it makes me, you know, I've had people say to me, it makes me cringe because it's so personal. And I say, well, then maybe you need to do some.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe you need to do some soul searching. You know, because it's stuff that lots of people deal with. It's not that crazy when you think about it. I mean, everybody in the music business has got a drug problem. You know, I mean, not everybody, of course, but that's a story that you hear over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So obviously, it's the human condition that we're talking about.
And it's also, you know? It's funny. The stuff you do is funny and it's witty.
Yeah.
So it's not, I don't see why it would really make people cringe.
And so tying this into your original question, you know, what? How is this different from what you were doing with the Czars? It was really important for me to start, you know, because I have a lot of friends who love me very much. And I wanted to, I have great friends, and I wanted to express what's good about me as well as what's bothers me and what has been difficult for me to deal with and what's, you know, shit about me. I mean, I wanted to show my sense of humor because that's one of the most developed things, you know, about my personality is my sense of humor. Also, I'm a huge fan of British humor. I've been going through, well, before I get onto that, I just wanted to say, so I didn't feel, I wasn't ready to express my personality with the Czars.
Mm.
I was still afraid of what I am.
Mm.
You know, I still was rejecting myself. And, you know, alcohol for me and the cocaine and everything, I mean, cocaine really took... Cocaine was not good for me because it was... My heart just couldn't take it. You know, I kept ending up in the emergency room, I think, three times I did that. And each time it cost like $3,000. And I was always like...
That's a deterrent, isn't it?
Yeah, because I was always like...
Coke's expensive enough as it is.
Exactly. And
that's a bad night out.
I never had any intention of paying a penny of those, you know, emergency room things. You know, I would go right in there and just say... They'd say, why are you here? I'd say, my chest hurts. And, of course, they admit you right away if you say your chest hurts.
Yeah.
That was...
Even though you knew why it hurt.
Well, that was the problem. And they'd say, well, what's going on? And I'd be like, oh, I just did a bunch of coke, because I wanted them to be able to help me. You know, but you wouldn't believe the kind of treatment you get when
you are that honest.
That's
what you have to do with the U.S. health system, presumably, as well as get in that way. Rather.
I mean, they can't really help you if they don't know what you've done, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
But I would tell them, and, you know, straight up like that, and then, you know, some of the nurses were just so mean, because they judge you, you know.
Yeah.
But, Yeah, I don't think, you know, during the Tsars, I wanted to obliterate my personality. I felt weak. I felt like a coward. I felt like I couldn't stand up for myself in this world because people were right about me.
Mm. So what do you think people are... it's interesting, standing out, Kate and I standing out watching you just this afternoon, you know, and the people who came to see you have an extraordinarily strong feeling. In fact, we'll have to wrap this up very soon because there's a line of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of people trying to get the autographs.
What is it you think that they are identifying with so strongly? Well, I presume that a lot of people email you and tell you the answer.
Yeah.
So what do they say?
Well, I think a lot of people, just like me, are tired of seeing people put on fronts. There's a lot of facades, and I think it's even more, you know, in the States, it's easier to talk about your problems because they do it all day long on the talk shows.
Absolutely.
You know, everybody goes to a psychiatrist, everybody has an analyst. You know, if you don't have one, then you're an outsider, you know.
Yeah. Yes,
but here in Europe, it's definitely, there's more facade building, I think. You're expected to keep on a happy face in public. You're not expected to talk about the things that you don't like about yourself.
Mm.
And you also aren't allowed to accept compliments either. It's sort of like a, you know, you're not allowed to say bad things about yourself, but you're also not allowed to accept compliments either.
Absolutely.
You have to reject those.
Absolutely.
But, and I think that people really identify with somebody saying, you know what, I've done all these things, I've had all these things happen to me, some of them have been nasty, I have a sense of humor about it, and you know what else? I like myself, in spite of this.
Mm.
I think that I am worth the trouble.
And I think we also expect confessional stuff to be gloomy in this country as well, and to find someone doing it with humour.
I agree. Yeah. It's
very good.
So, such a lightness of touch about what you do, and some of the musical idioms you use. There's some what certainly in England we would call music hall. Over here. It's a precisely different thing over there. They're kind of old musicals and showbiz, really.
Yeah.
You know.
I just love hearing someone in the audience crying out, "Chicken bones!"
Yeah, that's so beautiful, isn't it?
There's no. But I heard someone was going to do it. I was too shy, and then chicken bones came on.
I just love that. And you know, another reason I think my sense of humor really fits in with the British sense of humor because I get British humor.
Who are the British comedians? You were talking about this earlier. You didn't explain. Who are the British comedians that you like so much?
Well, you know, I worship Steve Coogan. Alan Partridge has been a huge part of my life for many years.
Anna's just come in to saying your public awaits. There's a line of people.
Right.
This is live broadcasting for you. Well, no, but just very quickly, so Alan Partridge,
I've been watching Nighty Night with Julie Davis.
Fantastic.
Which is blowing my mind. Human Remains, absolutely amazing. Mighty Boosh, Peep Show, Nathan Barley.
Nathan Barley.
Yes.
I mean, it's just endless. Oh, and I love Kathy Burke. Absolutely love Kathy Burke.
Perfect.
I think she's amazing.
It's so nice to hear that. And on that bombshell, shall leave it. Thank you so much, John, for
chicken
joining
bones.
Us. And as I chicken bones. Yeah. Anyway, as I say, your public awaits.
The Word, a magazine, a website, a podcast, a way of life.
That's John Grant talking to Mark and Kate yesterday in this very, very overheated porter cabin out the back of the Word stage. Listen to distant bass. There it is.
When drums stop, we've done this, haven't we?
We did that gag yesterday. I don't know if we talked about this yesterday. The wedding disco. I didn't actually see the wedding disco.
Did you hear about this?
Actually, Friday night, one of my daughters came back terribly excited. She said, "Oh, we had a great time. We went to the cheesy wedding disco." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Oh, you just go into it. You know, a particular part of the forest. And there's a stage, and there's kind of people dressed up as brides, you know, men dressed up as brides or whatever. And it's full of people dancing to that's what kind of music?" I said,
"Dancing Queen by Anna."
They said, "Oh, just really cheesy stuff." I said, "So what do you mean by cheesy stuff?" They said, "Oh, well, stuff that people like." You know, like ABBA and I don't know, whatever, and Frankie Goes to Hollywood and ABC and whatever.
Is it stuff you dance to when you're drunk?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. I said, so what makes it a wedding disco? And they said, "Well, it's because they play music that you like, you know," which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Sidelighting the whole wedding disco phenomenon. Anyway, last night when I was making my way back to the campsite, I went past the same place and the same disco, which is cheesy disco, I think it's called.
Fromage. Club Fromage.
Club Fromage.
The honk of fromage.
It's very good. They in the same place, they had a couple of guys on stage in Santa Claus, and it was Christmas disco. Christmas disco in the forest in the middle of August.
It's going to be New Year's Eve tonight.
I suppose it might well be. Might be a bar mitzvah or whatever. Yeah. I like the idea that you just take these festivals, you know, where are they, these particular festivals in the year, take them anywhere you want, you know, and anywhere it's going to engender the right kind of feeling. So there they were playing Elton John's Step Into Christmas. Is that what it's called?
Oh, that's perfect.
It's very good.
The wonderful irony of feeling it under the blazing sun or,
yes,
you know, the
well, it was
harvest
night,
mood
you know,
of summer.
So,
yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
It's fair enough. Yeah. Now, we just had a repeat performance at lunchtime today on Sunday from Tom Jones, who started the festival on Thursday night in the woods. And somehow they got him back at lunchtime to do the big stage.
Well, I think that's a Latitude tradition, actually. There's a sort of surprise guest.
Awesome.
Tom York, in fact, played this time last year at 11 o'clock in the morning on the Sunday, on his own, very successfully. So people look out for some surprise activity at the Obelisk stage. And, of course, the massive advantage is that he played when actually nobody else was playing. So there's no competition.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the other stage, the Lake stage, even the Word stage, haven't started up yet. So if you're actually... And also, it carries, therefore the sound carries,
yeah,
and dominates the entire site. So, you know, the best part of 25,000 people are going, what's that noise? You know, and some of them are going, it can't be Tom Jones.
Well, the voice is so unmistakable.
The voice is so unmistakable. And the interesting Tom Jones has gone through, we were talking about this yesterday, Johnny Cash is probably the place
to start. Template. Yeah.
Johnny Cash, I suppose at some stage, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, was a slightly down at heel, slightly on the back burner, slightly cheesy, actually, country and western singer who needed some kind of reactivation. And he then achieved this via Rick Rubin and some rather iconic black and white photography. He became somebody rebuilt into a kind of symbol of suffering, of integrity, enormous emotional resonance.
Mount Rushmore plays music.
Absolutely. And that template has been applied to various other people and is now currently being applied, let's be honest, to Tom Jones. What struck me this morning, I'm sure it's the same with you, is that the Tom Jones that I interviewed for a television interview about 4 or 5 years ago was a guy with dyed hair and a dyed goatee beard. His skin was a Hey Mr. Tangerine Man. His skin was bright orange. It really was. He looked radioactive, you know. And I think somebody must have said, I don't mean this unkind, because I'm very fond of Tom Jones, and I understand the difficulty of sustaining careers, and thank God, how long has this guy's career been, you know. But somebody has sat down there, presumably his management, managed in fact by his son, and said, first step is to reinvent Tom Jones into something that is authentic. You cannot be authentic if you dye your hair. You cannot be authentic if you dye your beard. Do you know what I mean? You've got to look like a normal person, and you've got to be able to sing songs that have a different kind of resonance.
And
so,
all his band members look like Waylon Jennings.
They all look like Waylon Jennings. No, exactly. Well, who are his...
Well, see, this is the interesting thing, you know. Looking at it from Tom Jones's point of view, you know, you put the name Tom Jones on the shingle, you know, and people expect Delilah, you know, it's
Las
not
Vegas.
Unusual. Las Vegas.
Yeah, Las Vegas, cabaret.
A bit of a
cabaret.
Laugh. You're going to be able to throw your underwear, you know, it's all that. Well, he's obviously made this record that's kind of quite rootsy and gospel-y, and yeah, it's fair enough. And it's, you know, what I heard, what he played of it today sounded very good. You know, and it's kind of keying into the Elvis gospel stuff and all that kind of thing. Somebody attempted to come in, they've changed their mind, gone out the door. But the problem is that you can't go out in front of the normal Tom Jones crowd and perform that, can
right.
you? You know, because he played quite downbeat. It started with What Good Am I? You know, very downbeat. I think an Elvis Presley song.
I was in the photographer's pit for a while, and people in the front row were shouting out for Delilah, and he kept on whispering, tomorrow, even though, of course, he's not playing tomorrow.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant.
So he was able, given the, you know, given what Latitude offers this particular weekend, to just do that particular part of it.
Yeah.
And he did it terribly well.
And it looks like he's
really good band.
Really enjoying it as well.
Oh, yeah.
Really
Ethan good. Johns, Ethan Johns, is the son of the great Glyn Johns, the great producer of Rolling Stones and the Eagles and various other people. And on guitar, who produced the record. Terribly good drummer.
Yeah.
Really craggy, rootsy, American-looking band, I felt. That,
but,
you know.
With a British accent. The drummer had a British accent.
Oh, OK, well, fine.
So,
he could be one of us.
But there's a classic moment of old Tom Jones. If you notice, when he introduced the band, then he introduced the backing vocals.
Right, yeah.
He said, I'm not going to do a patronising Welsh accent, but he sort of goes, three lovely girls. He said, sisters. He sort of went, yes, I know.
Oh!
that's old
there's
Tom
nothing
Jones.
Nothing wrong
go
with
back.
That.
Go back.
No, there's nothing no, wrong no, with that funny. Sort. So, you know, I thought he was terribly good.
No, he was absolutely fantastic. And I was quite pleased because I was trying to explain to my mate, you know, this concept that we're talking about now. And I said, well, you know, one of the things people tend to do, I haven't heard the record, disgracefully, because the record's been out for about a month, but is they tend to bring in great, big, three-dimensional, deep, rootsy songs that are often have gospel. He just played a gospel song. So what you need now is a blues spiritual, and what he plays is a John Lee Hooker song.
Yeah.
So I was covered in glory. It worked. Don't you think?
Oh, I thought it worked. I thought he did very well. Very well. Somebody else that we talked to recently was Melvin Benn, who's the person who put the whole Latitude concept together. Mark had a chat with him a few hours ago and started by asking what were his own personal experiences of being a festival goer.
Well, I think you and I are probably about the same age, actually, then. So I was going to ask you just about festival experience generally. You know, when I was a teenager, I was going to Reading, I was going to Wheeling, I was going to Lincoln, and I should imagine you probably attended a few events like that. And what, you know, looking back at those festivals, you know, what were things have improved unimaginably, haven't they? You think of the level of suffering, not that we considered it to be suffering, of course, at the time, that we had to endure to see Doctor Strange and Stranger.
No, to be honest, I mean, my, you know, Reading was the one that I used to go to, and I went for 5 or 6 years on the trot from 1972 onwards. So my first one was 72.
And who would have been in the sort of rough headliners in 72?
The Faces.
Kicking the footballs into the crowd.
Yeah, of course.
Yes,
yeah, very much so. And of course, nobody had ever heard of festivals then, really. And all my mates, we were all football mad and rugby mad. And, you know, I grew up in Hull and, you know, Hull City and Hull Kingston Rovers. That was what we lived for, really. And then me and my mate decided that we'd go to Reading, and all of my mates thought we were completely... They just thought, well, what are you going to do that for? And it's like...
To the beautiful
sights. You know, just... Yes. Yeah, I mean, and I'm not sure that I'd even been out of Yorkshire at that point, and genuinely, I'd never been on holiday, and I don't think I'd ever been out of Yorkshire. I'd been to Withamsea and Bridlington, but I'd never been... You know, but even then...
Alan Bennett for a moment.
And we hitchhiked down to Reading, and we didn't take anything. We didn't, you know, it wasn't... I mean, now you can come to a festival and just turn up and have nothing with you, because Tangerine Fields camping or pod pads, or you can hire a yurt and all
completely.
The... You can, everything here is there. I didn't even have a bag with me. We just took the clothes that we were stuck in.
We had exactly the same experience. I went to a festival once, and we were sold old fertiliser sacks by a farmer for 50 pence to sleep in.
And at Reading then, there was this stall that sold plastic, and it was big rolls of plastic, and you bought it for 50p.
Yeah, just a piece
and,
of sheet,
and it was, and it was a sheet, and it was 50p because it was just after decimalisation, literally.
That's
it was
right.
A year after decimalisation, and you bought it for 50p, and it was you wrapped yourself around in it and slept on the ground, and it's like no thought of tent.
And thought you'd be dry,
like
in fact woke up soaking wet
completely,
in your own condensation. Extremely unpleasant experience.
So festivals have very much been part of my life all that time, and they have changed, of course.
But what is interesting point is, what do you think? Because you're the promoter of your company, Festival Republic. You do Leeds, you do Reading, I think you do the Big Chill. You were very involved for a while in Glastonbury. You know, so what do you think the big significant changes have been? Broadly, things like diversity, I suppose, would be one. You know, that the range of things that we're able to see this weekend at Latitude is absolutely unbelievable compared with how narrow the vision would have been, you know, in 1972.
Well, I mean, certainly the diversity is very much part of it, but not everywhere, really. I mean, you know, Reading, you know, interestingly, and Reading and Leeds now, but Reading hasn't actually strayed very far from those days.
The
model of when you and I went.
Absolutely,
and
it's a specific kind of person.
It's a specific
kind of music.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And you know, interesting. Reading will always be my favourite festival, and is my favourite festival because it's entirely... there's no frills about Reading. It's just about the music. There's no... Hugh Stevens, you know, said to me a few years ago, we was just stood on the stage, and obviously at Latitude and a whole number of festivals, there's so many things going on, and, you know, there's clowns and, you know, circus acts, and not so much at last year, but certainly at other festivals. And Hugh said to me one day, he said, the thing about Reading is that... And he said, you should make it part of your strap line. And he said, and I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but anyway, he said to me, you should just put it, there's no fucking clowns here. and that is what Reading is. And in that sense, Reading's model has never changed. The toilets are marginally better. The organisation is substantially better, and actually the artists are phenomenally better, in my view. And I genuinely believe that acts get better and better.
Yeah, I think so.
And you know, of course, it was fantastic seeing the faces. But, you know, bands now are, you know, they're very organised. They're much more... You're much more likely to see a great set at a festival from a band nowadays than you would have been 30 years ago.
But isn't that partly because they've realised that there's a huge difference between playing inside with a roof over your head to a load of people who paid £35 specifically to see you, and trying to catch the attention of somebody wandering past on the way to the cabaret tent, quarter of a mile away? And it's now greatest hits, isn't it?
Yeah.
The feeling I saw, I've seen a lot of the acts, the feeling of absolute past masters of this, even at a very early stage. They just give you a kind of Queen-style medley of their greatest hits.
No, completely.
And that's what you want.
Well, it is what you want. And to be honest, if you don't give a festival audience that, it can go very badly wrong. And I've seen it go very badly wrong with a couple of acts that really have wanted to be, you know, too much up their own arse, really.
So can I ask you to name those names? Of course you can ask.
You can ask till the cows come home. I probably would avoid it.
But on a note of people that you are quite happy to say how much you enjoyed, I can remember talking to you once about Nirvana at Reading. I think you said that was the single greatest performance that you'd seen at that particular time.
At that time, I mean, to be fair, Rage Against the Machine are probably the archetypal and most down the line band for what Reading is now, and they bring that purity that is Reading. No frills. You know, Zach will get on stage and say, you know, they'll play the first song, they'll then say, you know, we're Rage Against the Machine, we're from Los Angeles, California, and then it's mayhem. It's just mayhem. It's musical mayhem. And that, again, is what Reading is. So it works perfectly for that.
I really like the idea that you are involved in so many different things, but you can still completely understand the relevance of that act for that audience. Because, you know, here you are putting on Florence and the Machine, who I saw the other night, who couldn't be further across the scale. The most theatrical, whimsical, almost operatic performance, you know, again, for a completely different audience.
So it must be very
satisfying to be able to find the right bands for the right constituency.
It is. And, to be honest, it's probably the most rewarding thing about the whole thing. I mean, it's great to, you know, see everybody coming to the festival and things like that. But, you know, just making sure that each... It's horribly twee in a way, but, I mean, all the festivals, I treat them like my kids.
I
nurture them, but I nurture them in different ways. They all have their own character and characteristics, and I just sort of grow them.
What is the characteristic of this one particularly? I mean, I can see lots of real hallmarks that have developed about last year. But what's your version of that?
Well, I mean, it's I mean, not being sort of disrespectful to any other part of the UK, it is incredibly English. And that, I think, is, you know, it's probably, I mean, it is middle class. Let's not beat about the bush. It is middle, a relatively middle class festival.
Yeah.
Its characteristic
is... literary tent, the cabaret tent, and Sadler's Wells.
But again, it's not exactly, and you know, it isn't. It's not by coincidence that when you come in from the main entrance and the campsite, the very first two things that you come across are the poetry tent and the literature tent. They are at the heart of the festival, as opposed to being...
No, that's literally setting the stall out.
Indeed, as opposed to being on the periphery of the festival, which is what so many festivals do. The music is the core, and everything else is really an adjunct too. And I deliberately set out with Latitude to flip it, to put it the other way around.
Absolutely, that's a brilliant strategic move. I, for example, have finished up this morning at 11 o'clock, watching opera.
Yes.
Which I'm not an opera fan at all, and found myself almost by accident across in some distant forest thoroughly enjoying it. And I wouldn't normally do that.
So no, and again, that probably one of the characteristics of Latitude is sort of accessible discovery. It's still a relatively small site, and particularly where all the entertainment takes place, it's easy to get around. And in moving around, you will discover something that otherwise you wouldn't have seen or enjoyed, or even thought that you might ever go and bother watching.
There was a headliner in it might be New Musical Express or something I read recently about you banning flags. Am I right? At Reading, was that right?
That was 2 years ago. It was prior to last year's event, actually.
But I thought that was an extremely good move, because that kind of thing. It's funny how the tiniest, and anybody listening to this who's been to festivals, i.e. the majority of people, will know just how amazingly irritating it is.
No, they can be incredible.
So if you'd have got in position to see the group you've been waiting to see, and someone's erected an enormous banner saying "Hello, Keith."
Yeah. Exactly, you know, or, you know, I love sausages.
I love
or
sausages,
something.
Exactly.
And it just completely drives you nuts, you know. So
how do you affect a ban on flags? I mean, it's fascinating.
Well, I mean, you just sort of, you know, you just... I mean, in a way, it's sort of how you affect how society has affected the ban on smoking, is that actually largely it becomes peer pressure. If you have this position that's not allowed, and it's very difficult to police that externally or with a small number of security personnel. And it's peer pressure, because when it's become banned, the person next to you feels legitimate in saying...
This is
banned, you know, we're sick of these things, you know. So it's actually peer pressure that does that.
So what would you like to ban next? Will umbrellas be next? Do you think a parasol?
No.
It's
probably best not to. It wouldn't be... there wouldn't be very many items that are banned, but there'd probably be a few people, but I'm not going to go there.
No, that's...
It'd be a long list of people as well, actually. Among them will be all those... Yeah, I'm sure you have, but will be all those people currently proposing a 25% cut in the arts. They would certainly be at the top of it, actually.
Yes, I can understand you've had your tangles with them. Is there a policy that you operate here? I can tell that there is to some extent. Well, you're not necessarily looking for putting 90% of your budget into U2 or into Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. You're not going to find Neil Young. I mean, the general... the general mix has been either quite alternative fringe comedy and literary figures, and then very, very new acts. The fact that you're headlining with people like Florence and people like Edmund Sun and The National. I mean, that's a policy, presumably.
It's a policy of... it's certainly a policy of... it's both policy and budgetary, really. In order to have the diversity that Latitude has got, it costs an awful lot of money to have the Royal Opera House here, to have Sadler's Wells, to have, Sebastian Folks, you know, to have not necessarily in individual fees, but in infrastructure and capability of being able to house all these things. And in order to do that and keep a ticket price at a certain level, you also have to then limit how much you can spend on a headline act.
Completely.
And if all your budget goes on the big superstar, well, it does two things. A, it means you've got nothing left to spend on anything else, and then it becomes the superstar show as opposed to a festival. But B, it over-dominates it. And that just was never the intention here. As I mentioned, the absolute intention was this... All the arts arenas were the starting point. What I really wanted to do was create a live version of a Sunday broadsheet. And very happy to... You know, sit on a Sunday morning and read, you know, one of the broadsheets or a number of the broadsheets, and read reviews of books, read reviews of films, read reviews of art exhibitions, of, you know, poetry, you know, the whole thing, the whole gamut.
And I bring that to life.
And I wanted to bring it to life,
so
basically.
Really well,
because I could tell from my friends that I wasn't the only person enjoying that level of diversity of culture, and I just thought, Yeah, I could. We could do this. I could make this work, actually. And of course, my team thought that I was nuts, really, because everybody knows. Well, because everybody knows Reading is probably my favorite. You know, is my favorite festival, and for all the reasons that we've talked about, and when I announced to my team that I was going to create a festival that, at the heart of it, was literature and poetry. I think they really did think that I'd been out on the town too long.
So you leave your senses.
They embraced it, and I think without doubt, it, you know, virtually all of my staff, a lot of my staff get involved very creatively in it. It isn't just the person that normally does all the passes for the artists and the guest list. She programs the In the Woods stage, and she also creates the kids area. There's a lot of my staff get involved in lots of different levels on all sorts of creative levels. And, for them, it's been terrific, even though they couldn't quite believe that I was suggesting
it. Must be very exciting. I came into the site very early the other day with this fantastic production pass that I've got. I can get in before anyone else, because it was still locked up. And wandered around on my own, watched Bell and Sebastian's string section sound checking. And you then get to look at the whole thing in context and think, I was trying to imagine what it would be like when you first found this site. I don't know how you found Henham Park, but to look around and see the potential. You suddenly look up and there's a forest across a lake, and we could have a band playing on the lake. And,
yeah, I mean,
we could do all sorts of things up in the woods. It must have been very exciting.
It was, to be honest. And interestingly enough, it was going back to that sort of that thought of making one festival different to another. I'd had the idea of Latitude in my head for about 3 years, but I needed a very beautiful place and a very special place to do it in order to make it work. I'd looked at lots of different places, and one of my a girl that used to work for me actually grew up across the road, and she rang me and said, "Look, you really should come and look at it. It's very nice." And I thought, so I sent my site manager down to look at the festival, and he came down, and it's sort of like looking at a house when you're house hunting or flat buying, or
we'll take it.
You go into a place and immediately it's right, or immediately it's wrong.
That, yeah.
And he was here, and he rang me, and he rang me from probably not far away from where we're sat now, and I had not been at that point, and he said, "Melvin, this is really, really nice, but there's two problems with it. I think we could, try and work something out, but there's two problems with it. And the problem is that there's this bloody great lake in the middle of the site, and it's full of woods. And of course, a lake in the middle of Reading, or Reading being full of woods, would be an absolute disaster.
Full-time staff fishing people out by their underpants.
And literally...
And dredging for cans.
So his concept of what he was looking for was based on other festivals in that sense. But, of course, I was in that slightly advantageous position of knowing what I want. And I said, "Actually, that sounds almost exactly what I'm looking for." And he said, "What?" I said, "I'm going to come and look." And I came and looked, and again, immediately just fell in love with it and knew exactly what I wanted to create.
Well, I can't help thinking that there can hardly be any stately homes with parks in the United Kingdom that are now not already signed up by a festival promoter. So you're very lucky to get it. But look, I won't hold you up any longer, because I know you've got to get back on the electric cart.
No, indeed.
And charge around. But thank you so much for coming.
No, my pleasure, and thank you.
Any changes next year, or is it too early to say?
No, it's much too early to say. I mean, I increased the capacity this year from 30,000 last year to 35 this year. I'm going to stick at that. So capacity-wise and general overall structure-wise, there won't be too many changes. But enjoyment-wise, it'll continue to grow.
Fantastic.
Melvin Benn, promoter of Latitude, talking to Mark earlier. And if you were listening to the podcast yesterday, one of our guests was Jeff Lloyd from Absolute Radio. It was great to have him here. And we was talking about, wasn't he, Mark, how he was worried about the offer he'd got to introduce Belle and Sebastian.
Well, that was just so funny, because we were actually just signing off and saying, "Thanks for coming along, and and on your way if you want to." And this, we then extended this for about 10 minutes, because we got more and more fascinated. And the idea was, if asked to introduce Belle and Sebastian to a crowd of best part of 15,000 people, what would you say? And Dave and I, being terrible old hacks and rather interfering, really weighed in with some suggestions, didn't we, about what we thought would be the right thing to do.
The audience appreciate a band being introduced, being bigged up.
Absolutely.
But the practical difficulty he had, because I saw him do it, is that he came on and he wasn't introducing them when they were coming straight away.
This is the key point, because we said that what you want to do, whatever you say, it's got to end with, and please welcome the mighty Belle and Sebastian.
First chord.
And what you want is Belle and Sebastian to be there and to play. You don't want any intermission, because it'll just completely sap the energy out of the moment.
Through no fault of Jeff's.
What actually happened was Belle and Sebastian either didn't want to be introduced or I don't know what happened, but anyway, he then had to introduce them as a part of a back announcement to the group playing before. Oh,
Crystal Castles,
weren't they?
Crystal Castles. That's
story. So what happens then is, no, carry on, because you were watching. You actually saw the back announcement, didn't you?
He did a very good. On this stage, in 15 minutes' time, will be a group who haven't played live in 4 years or something like this. And he said, I've always been a big fan, and if you like, does anybody here like the smell of secondhand bookshops? I think. Does anybody else here like lots of milk in their tea? He did another one.
Seaside in the Rain.
Seaside in the Rain. And got a really good, response from the audience. Now, so I wasn't there when Belle and Sebastian actually
hit the stage. We can piece this together brilliantly between the two of us. I then saw Stuart Murdoch's response. I hadn't heard Jeff, but obviously I could piece it together. So Jeff then goes, rather sarcastically, he goes... apparently we were introduced before. I thought it was quite funny. In a manner that suggests that the majority of right-minded people didn't think it was very funny. And what he said was, I have now, of course, drenched myself in eau de second-hand books, and I've put extra milk in my tea. So I could obviously work back from this as to what roughly had been said. But then Jeff, God bless him, I feel a lot of sympathy for him.
Absolutely.
Has just tweeted, what did he say?
Oh, he said, I took David Hepworth and Mark Ellen's advice, and it backfired. Well, but not his fault.
Don't feel bad
about it, Jeff.
Yeah.
Don't feel bad about it at all.
Not his fault. Not guilty.
I think everybody should, we are here to keep the red beach ball of entertainment in the air.
And of happiness and joy.
And if a member of Belle and Sebastian chooses to puncture that, and trample it like only a Scotsman can, don't feel bad about it.
He gave it his best shot, Jeff, I think.
So, next time you get an offer, do it again, Jeff.
Jeff, come to us anytime you want more advice. We're freely available.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word. Details at wordmagazine.co.uk.
This podcast is brought to you by The Word magazine, media partner of Latitude Festival 2010. For more details, go to www.latitudefestival.co.uk.